Many of us have had love affairs with cars at some stage of our lives, and they may have become environmental enemies, but they're still the main way we get from A to B, and there are always people who would like to do that very quickly. Thankfully, most of those people over the years have used racetracks, not State Highway 1. Historic New Zealand Racing Cars is a new book by Steve Holmes. Steve runs the Roaring Season website online, and he's spent many years as a prominent and respected motorsport and motor car writer. Steve Holmes, good morning.
Morning. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. You're a brave man because you've been very choosy with your car choices in this book, and you have racing, what we'd think of as racing cars in it, and some saloon cars. How did you do the triaging, the choosing? What were your criteria, Steve?
It was a tricky one. The concept for the book was actually created by a guy called Bill Honeybone, who I've known for probably around 10 years. We've done several books together. We could have either done 200 pages and had 200 cars with very little information on each, or we could do 200 pages and have a small number of cars and basically cover the entire history of those cars. And so I sort of opted for the latter option. And so we've ended up with 18 cars in the book.
And in covering those 18 cars, you pretty well covered the entire history of car racing in New Zealand, haven't you?
I guess I did. That was part of the concept for me. As soon as we came up with the idea for the book, there were a small number of cars which straight away I knew had to be included. I run a motorsport history website and discussion forum called The Roaring Season, and so I have quite a few members from all over the world, but predominantly New Zealand. And so I put it to some of my members. I said, I'm about to do this book on historic New Zealand racing cars. What would you guys suggest being in there? And so they sort of made some suggestions as well, and it was really thanks to a lot of their help with information, but also photographs. It can be quite hard to get very early photographs, that we were able to come to the collection of cars that we have.
You would have got a whole lot of people saying, what about my Triumph Stag? What about the Austin Healey? I mean, you would have got dozens of suggestions.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew the concept of what the book had to be when I first started out. It's called Historic New Zealand Racing Cars, but it really covers cars that have a New Zealand connection in one way or another. So some of the cars were built and raced in New Zealand by New Zealanders. Some of the cars were built internationally, Ferraris, Maseratis, for example, and they ended up spending a lot of their racing lives in New Zealand. And some of the cars were built internationally by New Zealanders who were based internationally, such as McLarens and McRae's and things like that.
Yes, you're always looking for cars that had the New Zealand stamp on them.
Exactly, yeah. And another criteria was that the cars had to have character. So they didn't necessarily had to be race winners or world beaters or have even won championships or anything like that. They just had to be cars of interest that were creative and in many respects sort of offered up some Kiwi ingenuity.
Why did the late 1940s and early 1950s produce the very best in Kiwi car ingenuity?
I guess because if you wanted to go motor racing at that time, you had to be inventive. You had to get clever. A lot of the cars that were built at that time, one of the cars that's featured in the book, the RA Vanguard, it was built by a guy called Hector Green down in Christchurch. And basically from the British government, he managed to get a set of blueprints for how the Germans built the Auto Union pre-war Grand Prix cars, which were actually funded by Adolf Hitler. And so after Germany had been conquered in World War II, they basically had to give up a lot of intellectual property. And that included the design and blueprints for the pre-war Mercedes-Benz and Auto Union Grand Prix racing cars. And so basically Heck Green and his business partners got a set of these blueprints and built a miniature version of an Auto Union with the engine in the back. And it was called the RA Vanguard because they used a Vanguard engine block. But basically everything else, right down to the wheels themselves, were actually made by Heck Green in his engineering workshop. For example, straight after the war, aluminium was extremely hard to come by. So what these guys would do was they would go to an army surplus auction, and they'd buy up old aeroplane propellers and things like that, melt them down, and they'd make parts out of them. So it was really out of necessity rather than these guys necessarily wanting to get creative. They just, if you wanted to go motor racing at that time, you didn't have a whole lot of choice. You had to get creative. So, it's. I think that's what we sort of refer to as Kiwi ingenuity.
So let's leave Bruce McLaren aside because we'll come to him. Mm. Anyone out of all the clever engineers in your book who was the sort of genius we should all know about, would Heck Green kind of sneak into that category?
Yeah, Heck Green is a bit of a standout. The cars were quite ingenious and extremely advanced, even in world terms, but he wasn't really known outside of New Zealand. He enjoyed the challenge of designing and building a car and overcoming its various engineering challenges, and then he'd sell it and build another one. So, quite a brilliant guy. And the RA Vanguard that I'm referring to, the car's actually been sold now overseas to a couple of Kiwis, a guy called Rob Whitehouse, who is a New Zealander, long-time New Zealand film director and television director, and he's been living in England for many, many years. And he and a guy called Paul Radisich, who many listeners will be aware of, those two bought the RA Vanguard. They've actually taken it to England and they're hoping to race it at Goodwood and other places. So it's a car that 60, 70 years after it was built is now finally getting some international recognition, which is long overdue.
If we had been a bigger country, given the skill levels of some of the heroes of your book,
yeah,
could we have built up a racing industry and in the end be known as a production country rather than a country of talented individuals?
I think it's highly, highly probable. Part of our problem is that we're so small and we're so isolated. So many of our clever people stayed here, but many of them also went over to England in search of work, and they were quickly snapped up. Great Britain is quite well renowned as being a country that is really the epicenter of world motor racing. And if you consider that the current Formula One field, which has 10 teams, 9 of those teams are actually based in England. And so, New Zealand most certainly could have been quite similar if we were larger and closer to the rest of the world.
Historic New Zealand racing cars, and Steve Holmes is with us. Seeing as special, the word special will be mentioned a bit. Can you define what a New Zealand special car was?
New Zealand special means something that was built in New Zealand by New Zealanders. So really the term became quite well used in the 1950s. So what happened in the 1950s is that we started having a couple of international racing events here that attracted teams from all over the world. Because you have to remember that New Zealand racing season takes place over our summer months, which is the middle of winter over in Europe and the United States. And so New Zealand was quite an appealing place to come to if you're a team owner or a racing driver and you wanted to escape the European winter. Come out to New Zealand and bring your Maserati 250F or your Ferrari or something like that, Formula One car. And you bring it out to New Zealand and you race it. And these were both international races, the New Zealand Grand Prix and the Lady Wigram Trophy in the 1950s and 60s. And so we would have basically current world Formula One drivers bringing their cars out to New Zealand to race. What they would often do is they would bring it out to New Zealand, they'd race it, and then they would usually sell it to a well-financed New Zealander, and the New Zealander would sort of keep it running one way or another, using as many parts as they could scrape together as possible. But if you weren't quite so well-financed, then you really had to build your own car to basically take on European Formula One teams. New Zealanders have a knack for building specials, building a car that is creative and is vastly different to perhaps how the manufacturer originally intended it. And so in many ways, New Zealand specials continued on in saloon car racing in the 1960s and 70s.
With modifications. They were modified.
Heavily, heavily modified, yeah. That seems to be the way that we like it, yeah.
You know, the 1961 New Zealand Grand Prix saw the Ferrari 256 lineup. And in the lineup, Bruce McLaren, Jack Brabham, Stirling Moss, Jim Clark, Dennis Hulme, all in the same race.
That's right.
Now, we look at the first guys off the grid in Formula One now and would laugh at the idea of them all being in New Zealand at the same place at the same time. We had it really going for us then.
Oh, we absolutely did, yeah. You're absolutely right. The modern-day equivalent would be for Mercedes-Benz Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren, Renault, Formula One teams to bring their cars out to New Zealand and do a series of races in New Zealand. We had current day Formula One teams and drivers coming out here to compete in the Tasman Series. It was a big deal. And in fact, Formula One teams back in those days would actually build what was known as a Tasman Special, because invariably we had slightly different engine regulations to what they allowed in Formula One, so they'd build a special larger engine to come and race in the Tasman Series. That was a big commitment to come out here and race in little old New Zealand. It's quite amazing when you think about it.
It's a proud and very clever history.
Hmm.
Let's talk about modifications and maybe some of the names of cars we know. Mm. Why choose a relatively unprepossessing car like, say, the Austin A40 to modify and race? What was the appeal of that kind of endeavour?
Oftentimes it was whatever you could get your hands on. The people that built the specials in the 1950s, those sort of creative minds in the 1960s began getting involved in saloon car racing, mostly dominated by Mark 1 and Mark 2 Jaguars, and Ernie Sprague from Timaru had a Mark 3 Zephyr, and Harold Heasley actually won the first New Zealand saloon series in 1960 in a Humber 80. And then we had the Lotus Cortinas that were beginning to come in. And then a couple of clever people realised that if you fitted the Lotus twin cam engine from a Lotus Cortina into the Ford Anglia, the Anglia is smaller and lighter, it would be a faster race car. These cars were called the all-comer cars because essentially that sort of sums up what they were. It run what you brung almost. So these guys were basically fitting small block Chevy V8 engines into Ford Anglias, and there was an Auckland car dealer by the name of Garth Soonis, and he had an old Ferrari Formula One car, and it was a front engine car in the early 1960s. Nobody wanted to buy a front engine Formula One car, even a Ferrari. It meant nothing. It was basically a worthless car, and he was trying to sell this Ferrari, and nobody wanted to buy it, so he decided to tear the body off. He put a Morris Minor body over the top, and he put a small block Chevy V8 engine in it, and he went all-comer racing. it's staggering when you think about it, but that's just what we did. It was back then, we were almost the world's dumping ground for old Grand Prix cars, which is what makes it so fascinating. We would find ways to recommission an old racing car one way or another. It's just what we did.
You'd have loved to get behind the wheel of that Morris Minor, wouldn't you?
It was very fast and straight line, but didn't go around the corners too well.
And that wonderful muscle car, that Humber 80.
Yeah, exactly right. That's right.
These are great stories. But I want to ask you something, because you say in your book that saloon car racing in the 1950s, if we go back slightly, in New Zealand, consisted of driving up to the track in the stock standard car you drove to work and back each day, and then driving home again once you'd had a race. And looking back, that was so egalitarian, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, that's really how saloon car racing started in most countries. We think of saloon car racing now as being, the big popular series here that we all watch is the Australian V8 Supercar Series, which has been dominated by New Zealand drivers in the last few years. But the V8 Supercars is really an evolution of what saloon car racing was back in the 1950s. And so people would come along and bring maybe a pre-war Ford coupe or something like that, a 39 Ford coupe that they was their daily driver or something. And they would pop off any parts that might fall off as they were racing, like the hubcaps, paint a number on the side, and they'd race it, and then they'd drive it home again. And that's how saloon car racing really started.
We mentioned the Ford Capri, actually, very recently, just because it was once test-driven to 110 miles an hour by a very intrepid 80-year-old woman. The Capri RS 2600 is in your book. Was this the car used in the TV series Minder with Dennis Waterman behind the wheel? Was that the same car?
They did use a Ford Capri in Minder, but this particular Ford Capri, the RS 2600, was actually what they called a homologation special. So back in the early 1970s...
What's that word again? Homologation?
Homologation, yeah. What it basically means is that when a manufacturer wants to take a saloon car racing, when they want to take it circuit racing, it has to be homologated through the FIA. In the early 1970s, Ford were wanting to win the European Touring Car Championship. It carried a lot of weight. To qualify, first of all, they would have to have sold, say, 5,000 cars in a single 12-month period. And then what they could do was build a homologation special where they'd only have to build, I think at the time it was about 250 cars. But those 250 cars would be fitted with parts that they could then carry across to the race car that then would then make the race car more successful. At the end of each year, a select number of people could actually then buy these cars off the Ford factory team, because the Ford factory team was going to build whole new cars, bigger and better, for the following season. So in late 1973, Paul Fahey was able to buy one of these very, very special RS2600 Group 2 racing cars and bring it out to New Zealand.
Interesting little deals and traditions that went on back then.
Mm.
A couple of more general questions. You can bore out an engine, or you can put snorkel scoops on the bonnet or whatever, and the objective is speed. But, yep, of course, you can go much faster just as a passenger on the bullet train.
It's true.
It's the producing of the speed, yeah? Speed is the way you measure the bright ideas.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's really what you can conjure up under the set of regulations that you're dealing with at the time.
Okay. And the best measure of a driver, because if you have the same horsepower and all the same trim and spoilers as all the others, that is the real test, isn't it? Rather than what happened in the workshop that somebody did before you got on the track.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. And you'll find with a lot of racing drivers, they all have quite large egos, and so they want the concept to be that the reason that the car won the race was because the driver was so good. But you're absolutely right. I mentioned Paul Fahey's Capri RS2600. He won many championships. He was a very good driver, but he also always had very good equipment, and he hired the best people to keep his cars well-maintained and have the best parts for them. So they were always beautifully presented, and they were always reliable, which was a big, big thing in New Zealand back in the 60s and the 70s. Cars were often very, very unreliable. I remember back in the 1980s when a lot of saloon car racing, sports sedan racing and that sort of thing for heavily modified New Zealand sedans used to be televised, and David Oxton used to do the television commentary, and he used to call a lot of these cars hand grenades, because basically they'd do half a lap and blow up. And so reliability was a big, big part of it as well.
You did, right. Cars were unreliable. I remember stopping my Triumph Herald by bumping it against the curb going down Stewart Street in Dunedin. Brakes would fail, all manner of horrific things.
Exactly, yeah. It was just part of what we did back then, wasn't it? But it's not normal anymore. It's not acceptable anymore, is it?
From that end of things to sheer excellence, can you tell us the story of the M8A? And for people who don't know, how Bruce McLaren became one of the absolutely towering names in both Formula One and supercars?
Yeah, so essentially what a lot of people don't know is that the McLaren team that currently competes in Formula One and also builds road-going supercars got its name from a young New Zealand racing driver called Bruce McLaren. So he got his break in the late 1950s racing here in New Zealand at some of the events that I'd mentioned, the New Zealand Grand Prix, when the international teams used to come out here. He got his break with John Cooper, who ran a Formula One team called Cooper. And he went over, just like Jack Brabham from Australia, Denny Holm, Chris Amon. These guys would get their break because of the international Grand Prix events that we had taking place out here in New Zealand. Bruce McLaren, he became the youngest driver to win a Formula One Grand Prix. He was a very good racing driver, but he was a very gifted engineer as well. And so he would engineer his own racing cars even when he was racing for Coopers. And eventually he decided to start his own team using his own name. He created the series of sports cars for the Can-Am series, and it was extremely lucrative for the McLaren company. And the money that came from the Can-Am series was filtered into the Formula One team and really set it up financially for the successes that carried on. And one of the cars that they built for 1968, which is one of the cars that is featured in the book, the McLaren M8A, it won the 1968 Can-Am Championship, and his teammate was fellow Kiwi Denny Holm. Bruce McLaren himself was actually killed in 1970 testing one of his Can-Am cars, but his name continues on in Formula One and the road-going McLaren Formula One and the road-going supercar company. So he's probably the best known of the New Zealand racing car builders.
Yeah, and a great, great figure.
Yeah.
Great book, Historic New Zealand Racing Cars. Steve Holmes has been with us. And thank you for all the effort you put into this. And I know you had a bit of help, but you did an awful lot yourself. And you've ended up with a very handsome result.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I hope that people enjoy the book.
Steve Holmes.